We continue this morning as we continue looking at inspiration, looking at evidences for biblical inspiration. Last week we talked about the things that inspiration was and was not, what inspiration gave the men that were inspired and what it did not give those men, you know, that it did not make their lives perfect, it did not wash away their sins, it did not give them things that are physical abilities that they would not have normally had. They just simply were the pen for God's message. Well, we ended last week's class beginning a discussion about prophecy. Prophecy being really one of those powerful, powerful evidences for inspiration. And we discussed how we can't even predict what's going to happen 2 seconds from now for us, or, you know, 10 minutes from now. How can we then think that men wrote about things that were going to happen thousands or hundreds of years into the future? And we simply know that that is not possible except with God. And I want us to take this morning, we're going to go through and look at some prophecies, and we're going to see the detail of the prophecies that the Bible lays forth and how these prophecies are eventually fulfilled. Beginning with Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, we see the first of 300 messianic prophecies that are in the Old Testament. There are 300 prophecies in the Old Testament that deal with Jesus Christ and His coming and things that He would do. And this is the very first of them. In chapter 3 and verse 15, we know the context of what's taking place here. Adam and Eve have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They have realized that they were naked and tried to cover themselves. They have hid themselves from God. And God has, of course, found them. Maybe that's not the accurate way to say that. He didn't find them. He never lost them. He knew exactly where they were all along. God had uncovered them, I guess we could say. And He is now speaking to them in regards to what is going to take place as a result of their sin. Now, verse 14, He condemns the serpent. But in verse 15, He goes on to say, "And I will put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. And he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel." That's the first messianic prophecy. We're talking about Jesus Christ here, that one was going to come, the seed of woman. Now, why would Jesus be, in this particular prophecy, the seed of woman? Because the human aspect of him coming was through his mother. His father was not Joseph. His father was not a man. His father was God. And so it was going to be through a woman that he would come, the physical aspect would be through a woman. And he would come and he would, in process, stomp on Satan. But Satan would be able to injure him too, right? And we see that. We understand that. As we see it fulfilled in the fact that when Jesus Christ died on the cross and rose from the dead, he conquered sin, conquered death, he conquered Satan. And he destroyed Satan's power. But in the process, he was injured. The crucifixion, what he had to endure, the sacrifice that he had to make there upon the cross. So this is 4,000 years before Jesus Christ would hang on that cross. And here it is, God saying, this is what's going to happen. Because we understand that God does not learn anything. He will not learn anything about you tomorrow. Because He doesn't dwell in tomorrows and yesterdays. He dwells in eternity. He dwells, time as a creation by God, in the beginning of time, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. He created time. He looks at time like we look at the wall back there. And God, having perfect knowledge, all knowledge, does not learn anything. He knows everything. And that's why these prophecies can be so accurate. How they can be so correct. Because God's not guessing. And God's not having to make it happen later. He already knows it's going to happen. Because He's God. Now, that makes our brains hurt a little bit. I know it makes mine hurt. You know, to think about that. But that's why I have a finite brain and he has infinite knowledge, right? In the presence of God, we are an embarrassing ignorance. And we think we're so smart, don't we? I mean, sometimes, you know, we get to thinking, preachers especially, boy, I sure know a lot. But when you stand before God, you're going to realize just how ignorant you are. Isaiah was a pretty smart guy. In fact, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Isaiah wrote the most beautiful poetry in all the Bible. Better than the Psalms, better than Proverbs, better than any of those. His book and its writing is the most scholarly and the most beautiful writing of all. He was a very intelligent man. Isaiah was intelligent. Right up until he came before God in Isaiah 6, right? Oh, I'm a man of unclean lips. He's a pretty good guy too, but he's realized how sin, you know, he has all his sins. I live amongst a people of unclean lips. He realized that God was so much greater. Well, let's move forward just a little bit to Genesis chapter 15 as God continues to prepare the way for this seed of woman to crush or to bruise the head of Satan. Genesis chapter 15 and verses 13 through 17. And it says, God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. So this is God's promise to Abraham concerning his descendants. Your descendants are going to be like the sands of the seashore, right? Like the stars of the sky. Well, that's kind of hard for Abraham to put his hands around, right? I mean, here he is. He's rather old, and he still doesn't have any children. And yet God's telling him how great his descendants are going to be. And in fact, he's going to get so impatient, isn't he, that he's going to try to take care of that situation himself. And we have to be careful about that, right? That we don't get impatient with God and try to do it our way. That we always have faith that God will take care of things, that God will do them His way as long as we stay with His way. And he made a terrible mistake with Hagar and Ishmael, a mistake that would continue to plague him and continues to plague us to this very day. Between those peoples. But God here says your descendants are going to be vast. They're going to be many. But he goes on to say as well that your descendants are going to be strangers in a land that is not theirs. And they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will judge the nation whom they will serve, and they will come out. So at the end of this whole prophecy section, we're going to talk more about what he says in it. They have cut these animals in half. I don't know if y'all if we talked about this before, but they would cut animals in half. And they would put them on each side of this little place to walk between them. And the point being, and there at the end, we see God represented by this fire that going down between them, is that I walk between these and I will keep this prophecy, or what has happened to these animals will happen to me. That if I do not do what I promise or I make this covenant in regards to, then I am to be cut in half just like these animals have been cut in half. That's the promise. So God's saying, you know, I'll either keep this promise or I'll be destroyed. But we know that God did not need such things. He's going to keep His promises regardless. But this was more for Abraham and to assure him that God was going to do exactly what He said. Now, He says that these descendants of Abraham are going to be enslaved for 400 years. All right, so we're talking about something 400 years out. Our nation has only been on this earth a little over 200 years, right? So we're talking almost twice as long as the United States has been in existence that this prophecy is going to stretch across. And yet God's going to nail it down to the generation. This isn't something you can guess at. How does he know that if this is a guessing game, how does he know that Joseph is going to go down into the land of Egypt, that his brother is going to come down there in a famine, that they're eventually going to move the whole family down there, right? And eventually there's going to be a day when there's a Pharaoh that doesn't know Joseph. And they're going to decide to enslave him, right? So 400 years. We have this in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 17, we have 430 years. And that is backing up all the way to the original promise by God to Abraham. but 400 years of enslavement. So from the time that Ishmael, and that's where this time begins to mark, is at the point of Ishmael being picked up, or picking on Isaac. Because Ishmael, his mother was an Egyptian. So we begin counting those years from that point. We have 215 years from the time that God makes these initial promises to Abraham to the time that the children of Israel go into the land of Egypt, and 215 years from the time they go into the land of Egypt to the time that they are delivered. So God then says, He says, not only will I bring judgment upon the land, which He did in the 10 plagues, but I will deliver them with a lot of possessions, right? Remember, after the firstborn was dead, the Egyptians decided they didn't need the Israelites anymore, right? Not just Pharaoh, all of them. They were ready. You know, we've had darkness, we've had hail, we've had frogs, we've had gnats, we've had lice, we've had it all. We've had it, I guess you could say. And they came out and they gave them their possessions. Just take this stuff and go. You know, anything to get them to leave. And so God says here, they will leave with many of their possessions. He says in the fourth generation, you can count them up. And it was in the fourth generation that Moses would lead those children of Israel out of the land of Canaan. And they are out of the land of Egypt and into the land of Canaan, rather. So we see here that this is an extremely accurate prediction. Let's just think about the four generations so we know for certain. Four generations go as far as in captivity. Levi, or in Egypt, Levi. Jochebed, who was Levi's daughter, Moses' mother. Amram, who is Moses' father. He married Jochebed, who was his grandfather's daughter. And so we have Jochebed, Amram, and then we have Moses. That's four generations right there in captivity. And so, you know, God predicted that with incredible accuracy. Well, we move forward to Joseph then. And Joseph has some dreams, doesn't he? Dreams probably would have been better that he kept to himself. But he didn't, right? You ever said something, you thought maybe that was better if I just kept that to myself? I figure when he was in the pit, he was thinking maybe I should have kept those dreams to myself. When he was being hauled off in slavery, he's probably thinking the same thing. But you know, he had the dreams of the sheaves and the stars bowing down to him, and the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down to him, right? And even when you're talking about the sun and the moon, you know, Jacob even asked, are you saying that I'm going to bow down to you? Yep, Dad, you are. That's exactly what it's saying, which didn't go over well with Dad. But, you know, he has these dreams of them bowing down to him. And that's decades into the future, right? And yet Joseph is being told of exactly what is going to take place. There is no logical line of reasoning that would ever cause his older brothers to bow down to him. It just didn't work that way in those days. You were a younger brother. Your older brothers are not going to bow down to you. They're over you in a patriarchal family. Where at first born or where you're born in that family is very important. And it has a lot to do with the authority that you have in that family. So there's no logical reason to believe or to think that his brothers would bow down to him. But yet God knew they would. And yet it would take him being sold into slavery, him being put into prison, him interpreting dreams, him then becoming the leader of Egypt, which is highly improbable for a prisoner, right? How does a prisoner get to being a prisoner one day to being the second in command of Egypt the next? Well, God. That's really the only explanation. And even there, we see another prophecy, do we not? With Pharaoh. What was Pharaoh's dream? Oh, the seven skinny cows and seven fat cows, right? And, you know, it's kind of a gross dream when you think about it. And seven skinny cows ate the seven fat cows. You know? And Joseph tells him exactly what that means. How do you predict famines? You know, these guys predicting the weather, right? Maybe the hurricane will come here. Maybe it'll go there. Maybe, who knows? It's going somewhere. It's out there. They can't even predict that, but yet he was able to predict 7 years of famine, 7 years away, and that they were going to have 7 good years. Wouldn't it be great if we could say, hey, we're going to have 7 good years. Let's really plant a lot of crops. 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, which would lead to his brothers bowing down to him. Well, you know, there are lots of prophecies that we can continue to look at. Let's go over to the book of Daniel and look at a number of prophecies there that have an incredible degree of accuracy. And, you know, to the point, Daniel's making prophecies hundreds of years out. But they are so accurate. I mean, the accuracy of them is so precise. As you go through the book, we will not have time to look at all the prophecies of Daniel because the whole last half of the book is just prophecies, chapters 6 through 12, or 7 through 12. But they are so accurate that theologians that do not want to hold to the inspiration of God in its fullness can't handle the book of Daniel. They have concocted a thought process or a theory that the book of Daniel was not written by Daniel. Now, there's a problem with that. Because over and over and over, and we could list many times that Daniel goes, I myself, Daniel, or I said, Daniel. I mean, he literally speaks of himself and calls himself by name. If you talk in chapter 4, you got Nebuchadnezzar saying, I, Nebuchadnezzar, he's speaking personally as he writes. So, if Daniel wasn't written by Daniel in Daniel's time, then the whole book of Daniel is a lie. But what they want to say is that the book of Daniel was written somewhere in the 2nd century B.C. during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. That it was written during that time because only that could then explain this writer, this anonymous Jewish writer that we don't know that uses the name Daniel, that he wrote the book to encourage the Jews during the Maccabean revolt. And that he was looking back on events and writing about them. But even that doesn't work. Because Daniel also talks about the Romans, which hadn't come yet. And he talks about the church, which hadn't come yet. And he talks about things in history and Babylon and Persia that someone during the Maccabean period would not have known. But someone that lived there would. And so it is an effort to explain away the detail of these prophecies. Because, see, if God really is the writer of the Bible, and you and I don't have a say in it, do we? It is not, as some religious groups say, that the Bible is inspired where it conforms to church doctrine. In other words, let's just put that in basic vernacular. The Bible is inspired where I agree with it. Right? And if I don't agree with it, that's not inspired. God didn't mean that. He didn't want that because I don't agree with that. But when we believe that God wrote every word, when we look at prophecies like this and we see that only God could write these words, then we will obey it. Then we will admit and know that God has what we need written down. So let's think about what some of the things that God put in here. Well, chapter 2, one that we know very well, and one that is laid out for us in multiple places, is the one with the dream by Nebuchadnezzar. He has a dream, right? And it frightens him. We see that repeatedly. Kings with frightening dreams in the book of Daniel. And he wants to know what this dream is about. Well, he calls in his wise men who were experts at telling kings what they wanted to hear, right? They didn't really have any power to interpret anything. They were con men. They were like Simon the sorcerer. They were putting on a show. They'd tell the king what he wanted to hear, what would be advantageous for them. But Nebuchadnezzar has a little plan for that, doesn't he? He seems to know exactly what they do. He says, not only do I want you to tell me what the dream means, I want you to what? Tell me what the dream is. Now, say I come up to you and go, I had a dream last night. Could you tell me what it means? What was your first thing? Well, what was your dream? not that it would matter. But if I said, no, you tell me what my dream was. You go, I don't know what your dream was. And they even tell him, no one can do this except gods. The gods. Now, they put the plural on it. Little g gods. Except the gods. And he's, in fact, they even go so far as to say, no king has ever asked a wise man to do such a thing. You know, come on, Nebuchadnezzar, you're being unreasonable. And so he orders them all to be killed, including Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He orders them all. And so Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they pray to God for an answer, to be able to answer the king. They go right to God. You know, when they find out that they're going, that they're on the head chopping list, they do not go, oh, no, what are we going to do? They go to God. And they pray, and he gives them the answer, doesn't he? Daniel goes into the king Nebuchadnezzar, and he says, you'll tell me what my dream is. He says, no, I won't tell you. God will. God will tell you what your dream is. And he'll tell you what it means. The dream was a great image, wasn't it? Tall image of a man. He had a gold head. He had silver breast and arms. He had a brass belly and thighs. He had iron legs iron legs with clay and iron mixed in the feet. And this rock was cut out of the mountain and it was brought down and it crushed him into dust. And that rock then grew to fill the entire earth. That was the image Nebuchadnezzar saw. And Daniel goes on to interpret that image. He says, you, O Nebuchadnezzar, you're king of kings. You are the head of gold. No one else like you. And it's not that Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was the largest kingdom in the world. It was that Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, probably there was never a kingdom that had so much power vested in one man. Nebuchadnezzar held all the power. You know, even when we see the Persians come, their power is divided up. Persians and Medes. And so here he is. He is one man that has all this power. And in fact, when he's not king anymore, the kingdom doesn't last long. Nebuchadnezzar was just that kind of a powerful personality. So he says, you're the head of gold. But he says, there's going to come a kingdom after you lesser than you. Right? He tells him then about the Persians and the Medes and what they would come. And they would come in 539. They would rule for 331. And, you know, Daniel is laying these kingdoms out, and these kingdoms we know come. After this is going to be a kingdom of brass, bronze, the Greek Empire. But, if you notice, there's a belly of bronze and thighs. That kingdom at one point is going to be very consolidated and strong, and another point is going to be divided, as legs are divided. Alexander the Great would come and he would, in some 10 years, conquer the entire known world and die just shortly thereafter around Babylon. And he would leave no heir, no successor. And in fact, his general said, because they were the only ones in the room, so we don't really know whether this was true or not, he said, to the strongest. And so the kingdom was divided up between his four generals. But now we only have two legs because we really only deal with two of those kingdoms, the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire, the two that are going to be in all these other prophecies in Daniel. So then he says, then there's going to be the legs of iron. And we're going to see that as also shown as a terrible beast that crushes all the other things underneath it later in the book of Daniel in prophecies. And that's the Roman Empire, that just by sheer power they had no strength as far as cohesiveness. Clay and iron will not hold together. They subjugated people by strength. You know, people weren't proud to be Romans, unless you were Roman, right? I'm so proud to be a part of the Roman Empire. I'm proud to be an American, okay? Now, I'm good portion American Indian, good portion German. I don't know what that makes me. It makes me irritable and I don't know, upset about trash being thrown on the road. I'm not, but, you know, I'm an American, though, and I'm proud of that. Romans conquered people, and those people didn't become proud to be Romans. They didn't want to be Romans. But there was no way that they could stop that. And the Rome crushed them if they got in the way. And that's how Rome operated. And that's why they were not a cohesive empire like the others were. They were an empire held together by iron, but it was not an empire that could hold together forever. And so during that time, during those kings, this great stone would be cut out. What is the stone? The church. And it would come down and it would crush all other kingdoms. And it would grow to fill the entire earth. And by Colossians chapter 1, just 30 years after the gospel began, on the day of Pentecost, Paul said that the gospel had gone to every corner of the earth. So it had grown to fill the earth. You know, that kingdom, the kingdom that would last forever, Nebuchadnezzar would acknowledge that kingdom that would last forever. That kingdom that would last forever, think of all the kingdoms that have come and gone, and yet here we still are today. The Romans tried to destroy us with their iron power, right? They're gone. They're in dust. Soviet Union tried to oppress Christianity. It's gone. Still here. Nation after nation have tried and tried throughout history. They are gone. And the church is still here. And when the Lord appears in the sky, however many more nations have come and gone, we will still be here. Because the kingdom is everlasting. It is forever. We move over to chapter 4 of Daniel. And Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar, has another dream. Once again, the wise men of his day cannot tell him what the dream means. But it is of this great tree, right? And the birds are in it, and the animals are under it. And there's, you know, it's this magnificent tree, and it's huge. And a voice from heaven calls down and says, chop it down. Cut off the limbs, chop it down, destroy it, and just leave the stump. Put a brass or a bronze ring around it. Do not let it grow. So God leaves this possibility of another tree growing, but cuts down the tree that was. Nebuchadnezzar finds out. Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, he says, O king, how I wish the interpretation of this dream was about your enemies. That'd be a whole lot easier. You always wanted to tell kings good things, right? They always, you know, I'm sure he liked being called the head of gold. Yeah, I'm the number one. I'm the guy on top. Because you look at it, in the next chapter after being told about the head of gold, about 17 years later, he builds a 98-foot tall image of gold and tells people to worship it. You think he might have been thinking, I don't want to just be the head. I'm going to be the whole thing. Make it all gold. And they're going to come worship me. Of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had something to say about that, didn't they? But here he is, and he says, O king, I wish it was about someone else, but it's about you. And that a year from now, you're going to be cast out. And you're going to go and you're going to crawl around in the fields like an animal and graze. And your hair is going to grow long and get matted, and your fingernails are going to grow long like claws. You're going to do this for seven periods. We believe 7 years. The Bible does not designate it, but there does appear to be seasonal aspects to it in the way that he's going to graze. And so 7 periods of time you're going to graze like this until you come to your senses. 1 year later, probably haven't forgot about what Daniel told him that day. King Nebuchadnezzar is standing on top of his palace, probably maybe even the Hanging Gardens of Babylon that he built for his wife. And he's looking at that enormous ziggurat to Marduk over there, looking at the massive walls, 300 feet tall in some places, and how great and grand a city he has built. And he says just that, look at what I have built. And God says, uh-uh. You didn't build it, buddy. And now you're going to learn some humility. And at that moment, his senses were taken from him. He was cast out. He he graced for 7 years, and the Bible says then he came to his senses, came to understand, he acknowledged God, that all dominion, all power comes from God, and that no power and no dominion on this earth exists except that God ordains it to exist and allows it to continue to exist. That's an important lesson for us. We're going to talk about that next Sunday morning. But the whole book of Daniel, the theme of the book is God controls the nations. That's it. That He is in control. And He knows exactly what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen, because He is the one that causes it to happen. Because He is God. And so He comes back and He is restored as king. See, the tree was left with the possibility of coming back, wasn't it? And we know from the time that Daniel interprets the handwriting on the wall for Belshazzar that King Nebuchadnezzar is considered a follower of God. But even on that night, you know, tonight your kingdom is ended. You've been weighed, you've been measured when he wrote on the wall, many, many tekel upharsin. You've been weighed, you've been measured, and your days are up, buddy. And tonight you'll die. That's what he told Belshazzar. And that night he died. As he sat in a city that he thought could not be taken. Well, you can think about those, and you can go on over to ones that maybe we don't look at as much. And I know I've talked about this, and so I'm not going to spend much time in dealing with the specifics of it. But you can go to Daniel chapter 9 and the 70 weeks prophecies that Gabriel gives in verse 24 to Daniel. And the precision of that bringing you to the exact year of our Lord's death is amazing. It's not like he got close or hit the decade or got in the right century or as the great image during the days of these kings, during the Roman Empire, which lasted for more than 1,000 years. You know, no, it's not that broad a stroke. It is a very precise this year, bringing right up to AD 30. A very precise this year to the year that Jesus Christ was baptized. Bringing a very precise moment to those things in these 70 weeks, these 490 years that God was prophesying in regards to the Messiah returning. If you look at the very beginning, you know that he's talking about the Messiah. Look at the things that he says that the Messiah will do in verse 24. He will finish the transgression. He will make an end of sin. He will make atonement for iniquity. He will bring everlasting righteousness, seal up vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy place. Jesus Christ came to put an end to sin, didn't he? To put an end to sin in your life and in my life, to destroy that sin, to wash it away, to forgive it, to make that atonement, to put an end to prophecy, that the perfect things that have come, we would no longer need the gifts of inspiration or prophecy, that we would have God's Word as a result of Jesus Christ delivering it to its perfection. Jude says that it was once delivered and it has been delivered to us. And then to anoint the holy place. Now the holy place in the Jewish mind is where? The temple. My friends, we are built up as a temple, aren't we? And Jesus Christ has anointed this holy place, not this building. You and me and everyone around you this morning as children of God. We are His temple. We are His anointed today. But maybe the best, and you know, there's no way we could have the time or would give the time necessarily to it this morning, is Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 takes and brings us through the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic empires. It literally tells us every little detail about their history. About how that they gave daughters to the other to deceive them. I mean, this is 400 years before the, or 300 years before these things would take place. And he's going to send his daughter, and she's going to be sent over there to deceive him, but she's not going to deceive him, she's going to join him. And that's going to cause all kinds of... And it's just, and you look in history, this is why these guys say he had to write it during this time, because this is too precise. Is there something too precise for God? Before you were, when you were in your mother's womb, I knew you. And every day of your life laid out before me. God knows everything. He could have given more precision, couldn't he, than what he gives in these prophecies. But he brings it all the way up. He works through the battles and the strife between the Ptolemaics, which were down in Egypt, and the Seleucids, which were up in the Syrian area. And Israel was in the middle. And all the battles had to cross through Israel. Their entire histories. He brings it right up to a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus the IV. He was the leader of the Seleucid Empire. He was the one, when we read about in Matthew chapter 24, if we want to go forward even more into the New Testament, and Jesus Christ making the prophecies in Matthew chapter 24 and Luke chapter 21 regarding the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Right? Now, he spends the first part of that talking about that. And there was two questions. He said that when they were sitting on the Mount of Olives looking across the Kidron Valley at the temple, and they said, oh, look at how beautiful the temple is. And it was a magnificent building. And Jesus said, not one stone will be left upon another. They said, when will these things take place, the one stone, and when is the return of your return? Now, that's two different questions. And Jesus answers them separately. So then he tells them about the destruction of Jerusalem. But at the end of, or during that prophecy, he talks about the abomination of desolation, right? That's from Daniel. Now, two different things. Prophecy here had a dual purpose. The abomination of desolation that Daniel talks about is when Antiochus would come to Jerusalem after being defeated in Egypt. He's angry. He's mad because he was defeated. The Romans defeated him and he's not happy. And so he's got to take it out on somebody. And here's Jerusalem on my way home. I'll take it out on them. I don't like them anyway. So he goes into the city. He slaughters thousands of Jews. He goes into the temple. He offers a pig on the altar and desecrates and shuts down all worship in Jerusalem. That was the abomination of desolation Daniel was talking about, the total desecration of the temple. Jesus was talking about the destruction of the temple in its entirety as he looked forward to AD 70 with his prophecy. But once again, another time in which the prophecies were so accurate. And then, I mean, we can even look, and we go back and we look at chapter 7 and chapters 8 of Daniel, and we see that God again talks about these beasts. He talks about where they came from, that they would come from the east, or they would come from this direction or that direction. But he always was very specific. He talks about Babylon, that they had wings, a set of wings. Wings in prophecy means that they would be swift, and Babylon did conquer very rapidly. But you come to the Persian Empire, they were a bear, you know, with ribs in their teeth, of the kingdoms they conquered. And they were big, and they were bad, and they were just as fearsome, but they were slow and lumbrous. You know, certainly not a leopard, right? And they would move around slow and lumbrous. And that's because when we look at the Persian Empire, we look at their armies numbered in the range of 500,000 to a million men. Then you have the leopard with two sets of wings. It's Alexander the Great. He came from the west, came across a body of water, crossed that body of water between Turkey and Greece, and came into the Persian Empire, butting his way all the way through, going all the way through. He's also described as a goat in chapter 8. Butting his way, just taking everything out in his way. But he would move very rapidly. He had two sets of wings. But also, he used very small armies. 40,000 men defeating 500,000. Alexander the Great's armies were incredible. So these prophecies are what we need to look at and what we need to see. And the Bible's filled with them. And these are just a few for us to look at and to consider. But these prophecies show God. Because there's no way. Do you know who the next kingdom's going to be in this earth that's going to be great? Oh, you can take a guess. Right? Look at who's maybe on the ascension right now. Who's on the decline. But you can't guess. Kingdoms when God has decided that you know, and there's going to come a day for the United States when it's written on the wall, meeny, meeny, tickle, you farson for us, right? You've been weighed, you've been measured, and you've been found wanting. And your days are up. And when God makes that decision, does it matter how many M1 Abrams tanks we have? Does it matter how big our economy is? Does it matter how many bombers we have? Does it matter how big our army is? We're done. Because the Babylonian Empire was still great on the night it fell. One night. We need to remember that. And God's prophecy shows us those things. And God's prophecy show us His inspiration of His Word. Appreciate your good attention this morning.